Okay, okay, okay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. And in the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050895, Ford Motor Company versus Tiburcio Ledesma Jr. from Bastrop County and 3rd Court of Appeals District. Docket number 050925, Eulo Yancey as guardian of the person and state of Carlita Yates versus United Surgical Partners International, Inc. and Judith Smith, RN from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 051100, Noemi Guevara versus Corazon Ferrer and Aaron Assani of Arturo Lavado from Harris County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We expect to complete all arguments before noon today. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050895, Ford Motor Company versus Tiburcio Ledesma Jr.
May it please the court, Mr. Morgan will present arguments for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes.
Good morning, Connors, and happy Valentine's Day. I would like to move directly to the issues in this appeal that most affect the jurisprudence of the state. In this case, two critical parts of the court's charge to the jury, both of which come from the PJC, did not correctly state the law. Those were the submission of the plaintiff's claim of manufacturing defect and the definition of producing cause. On both of these, this charge and the PJC omits any mention of what the courts hold are the essential elements of manufacturing defect and of a producing cause. Yet the PJC, which is not a source of law, was treated here and is being treated throughout the state as the source of law on both of these points. This case exemplifies the problem. Despite being given briefs specifically identifying the elements of the plaintiff's claim that were being omitted, citing authorities of the cases that hold those elements to be essential, both lower courts deferred to the PJC. The Court of Appeals, in fact, never said that the submissions in the charge did include the essential elements and were therefore actually correct. Instead, it said they came from the PJC and no court had ever expressly held them to be wrong. It therefore deferred to the PJC.
Assuming you're right about all that, the only possible defect in this case was a manufacturing defect.
Well,
if the jury fought any part of the plaintiff's testimony about defect, then their yes answer would have had to have related to a manufacturing defect.
Well, that's not actually correct, Your Honor, either factually or on the law. On the facts, it's not true that the plaintiff suggested only a deviation from the design. The design was at fault. Their expert, Gert Arts, suggested, in fact, that the design of the truck might be at fault, suggested that he might, in fact, have a better way of designing the axle leaf spring connection so that it would not come apart even if the nuts came off. He furthermore adamantly refused to say that a manufacturing defect meant that there had to be a deviation between the design of the product of the truck and the truck as it was produced, and instead told the jury several times that a design defect could be any time the vehicle did not function as intended. He said that several times, and that was never corrected. Furthermore, as a matter of law, no reported decision in this state, except the one below, has held that a plaintiff does not need to ask the jury if he has proven all elements of his cause of action if he pursues only one of them.
In what respect did they present evidence other than the manufacturing defect that the vehicle didn't perform as intended?
Well, Gert Arts, the plaintiff's expert, suggested that he could design, he could come up with a better design for the vehicle by coming up with a design for the axle leaf spring connection that would not come apart even if the nuts came loose, and that can be found on 5 Reporters Record, page 62. So there was a suggestion. The point is that the jury was never told what a manufacturing defect actually is. And that's the problem. They were told instead, if I direct the court's attention to the petitioner's handouts for oral argument, they were told that a manufacturing defect is any, on the next to last page in this handout, it shows the question as this was submitted to the jury, which comes almost verbatim from the pattern jury charge. And on the right is the question as Ford requested. Now, the most striking thing about the question that was actually submitted to the jury is it never actually says what a manufacturing defect is. That's the most striking thing. And this is odd at the outset, because in a design defect case, we tell the jury what a design defect is. We tell them what the law requires for there to be a design defect. In a negligence case, we tell the jury what the law requires for there to be negligence. In a misrepresentation case, we tell the jury what a law requires for there to be a misrepresentation. And then after defining those elements, we ask the jury if they've been proven. Neither of that is done here. The jury instead is told that they can find liability based upon a defect, which is defined to be a condition of the product that renders it dangerous to an extent beyond that which will be contemplated by the ordinary user.
So you're suggesting, and again, assume that we agree with that, that the instruction was in error here. What I'm interested in, I think Justice Brister is, what other sorts of conditions did the plaintiffs base their case on? You say the expert said a design defect or suggested a design
defect.
That's
correct, Your Honor.
What other possibilities might the jury have considered in answering this
question?
Well, yet?
He suggested, for example, that under his definition of what a manufacturing defect is that the product didn't function as intended, and it may have been that Ford did not intend for this axle leaf spring assembly to come apart if the axle hits a curve. Well, that's not what a manufacturing defect is. Whether the product functions as intended is not what a manufacturing defect is. At bottom, Your Honor, the problem is that saying this would be harmless error means that in certain factual situations, a plaintiff does not have to either prove an element of his case as a matter of law or get a jury finding on it.
We first have to address the no evidence point, correct?
No, Your Honor, we do not, because we believe that this is a no evidence point. If the jury does not return a finding on an essential elements of the, an element of the plaintiff's cause of action, despite the defendant's request that it be submitted, that is a no evidence point, and their proper remedy is reverse and render. This is a no evidence point. The plaintiff did not obtain a jury finding that there was a manufacturing defect in this vehicle as the courts of this state define the elements for that. Nor did the jury return a finding on the producing cause, as the courts of this state say the elements are required. And Ford requested that all those elements be submitted, and they were not. And the plaintiff cannot contend that they were proven as a matter of law. That's the bottom line here. The plaintiff who submits a cause of action to the jury has to either prove the elements of that cause of action as a matter of law or get the jury to return a finding on those elements. And neither of those happened here, despite Ford's objections and Ford's request.
In a number of cases where we found charge error and corrected that, we've remanded them.
Your Honor, I don't believe any of those cases involved the complete omission of an element of the plaintiff's cause of action. And in fact, in the St. Joseph Hospital versus Wolf case, that there was a reverse and render in that case. It's a little obscure because there were other issues involved. But in that case, one of the elements of a joint enterprise was not submitted, and the remedy was reverse and render. The other cases where there are just instructions, they did not submit elements of the plaintiff's case, that might be the appropriate remedy, but not here. But this is hot surprise. We raised this at every turn. We told the trial judge exactly what was being left out. We cited authorities saying these are the required elements for manufacturing defect. These are the required elements that are required, and they're not in the charge. At
what
that point,
the U-bolt
stuck up too far, or if it was off-center, which I understand to be the two defects complained about, those both have to be manufacturing defects.
Well, if they're proven, they may be. And if the jury had been properly asked, they might have so said. The problem is we do not know. They were not asked. And we have a right to either require the plaintiff to prove it as a matter of law, which they cannot contend they did, or get a jury finding.
Well, I mean, let's not be too hard on the plaintiffs here. They didn't just make up this instruction. It's been around 20 or 30 years and approved by the state bar, right?
Well, that's the problem, Your Honor.
And naturally, if the problem is one head stuck up higher than the other and nobody argues that was the way it was designed to do.
Well, Your Honor, there was dispute about whether that was a design defect. Our expert testified that was within specs. Both the existence of that, both the deviation from the design and the cause of this action that were hotly disputed. Both of them were. The jury did not return a finding that there was a deviation between the design of this vehicle between this vehicle, axle, leaf spring connection as it was designed and as it was manufactured. Now, the fact that it's been in the pattern jury charge for a long time, that's the problem, because the pattern jury charge is not entitled to deference. The committee that drafts it is not a court. It is not a legislature.
But they draft it based on the case law that we put
in. They're supposed to, Your Honor, but even the introduction says that it's just a guide and that it could be mistaken.
But we have cases that set this out as the definition of a manufacturing defect.
No, Your Honor.
There are cases that go both ways.
There is no reported decision in this state that says that a manufacturing defect is, quote, a condition of the product that renders it dangerous to an extent beyond that which would be contemplated by the ordinary user. None. There is no reported decision in this state that defines a manufacturing defect that way. None. It is only in the jury charge that we give the juries. There is no cause of action for a condition of the product that is dangerous to an extent beyond that which would be contemplated by the ordinary user. It's not in any of the statutes. It's not in any of the cases. It appears only in the charge that we give the jury.
So to what extent should a trial judge rely upon these pattern jury charges?
He should not rely on it at all. Once a question arises about whether it's legally correct, it is not a source of law. If a dispute arises about whether the jury charge correctly states the law, the PJCs should be set aside, and the judge should go to what the sources of law actually are, which are the decisions and the statutes.
Tell me some about your complaint about the trial court excluding the your expert. What was that about, and was error preserved? What was he going to say?
Oh, yes, error was preserved, Your Honor, in a pretrial hearing, and this is a reverse and remand point, obviously. He was an engineer who worked for Ford for many, many years, many decades, who was involved in designing leaf spring axle connection assemblies, and investigated for at least 5 to 8 years, I think, failures of those. He was prepared to testify that the sort of damage that occurred to this leaf spring assembly that was found on the assembly after the accident was not that which would be caused by the nuts coming loose, but was instead typical of a shearing forces of the right rear wheel of the Ledesma's truck hitting the left rear wheel of the Firebird. And he had also conducted an experiment with two exemplar vehicles, a Firebird and a Ford F-350, to show that that could have happened, and refute the contentions of the plaintiff's expert that it was impossible for those two wheels to contact. All that testimony was excluded because he was not an accident reconstructionist. He was not allowed to give any testimony at all on causation of any sort. And it's not necessary to be an accident reconstructionist for somebody with that background and experience to say this is not what happens. This is not the damage that occurs when nuts come loose. This is the damage to the components that happen when there's a severe shearing force, and that's what occurred here. That's a reverse and remand point, of course.
So trial judge excluded him. Where is the record, what you just told me about? If called, I would have said
this. Well, it's cited in our brief, Your Honor. It was a pretrial hearing on the admissibility of his testimony. It's a pretrial hearing.
Counsel or a deposition attached?
No, he testified. My recollection is that he was at the pretrial hearing and testified as to what he would have said at in a Daubert, you know.
Have to reoffer that at the time of trial?
Well, I would contend no, because it was a finding on the admissibility before, you know, before the trial.
Normally, pretrial rulings, certainly in motion in limine, don't preserve anything.
Well, that was not a motion in limine. It was a motion to exclude his testimony.
Recognize that. Question is, why should a pretrial conference, excluding somebody's testimony, preserve it when a motion in limine doesn't?
Well, that's just what the law says. That a motion in limine because a motion in limine is not asking for an exclusion. Technically speaking, it's asking for the parties to approach the bench before.
What the law says, you don't have to offer it again after the pretrial conference.
Well, it's cited in our brief, and I can't recall it offhand, in our reply brief. There are cases that say there are pretrial hearing on the admissible to admit or exclude testimony to preserve the error. And that's what was done here. I could file a supplemental brief if the court would like.
Don't continue your brief.
The other issue I'd like to mention is the producing cause, which is similarly defective, and although it's been used for a long time, in fact, the only reason it continues to be used is that it's in the PJC. If I turn too fast, the court directs attention to the last page here of our handout. Again, we have the definition that was given to the jury of producing cause, which is what comes from the PJC, and the definition that Ford requested it. Now, this definition of producing cause does not include what the cases say of the two essential elements, substantial factor and but-for causation. It doesn't mention either. Cases unanimously say that producing cause requires both, which is what Ford asked the jury be instructed. The jury was not asked whether either of those was proven. Instead, they were given this mystically cryptic phrase of efficient, exciting, or contributing cause. Now, let's be honest, Your Honor. Nobody has any idea what an efficient or exciting cause is. There do not seem to be any reported decisions defining either term. In fact, it seems that whenever a court of appeals has had to actually wrestle with a concept of producing cause, it may encant this mantra of efficient, exciting, and contributing, but then it hastens on to say, well, what it really means is substantial factor and cause in fact, which may be sometimes called but-for causation, and then applies it as Ford wanted it applied. No one has any idea what this really means. It's the PJC, in fact, did not use this phrase. This is the point.
Given your argument about the first instruction, if we were to find that definition given in an opinion from this court, would it be not reversible error to submit it in this case?
No, Your Honor, because this court has used that phrase, but it has also said the two elements are producing cause and cause in fact. This efficient, exciting, or contributing cause does not tell the jury what the two elements are. Compare it, for example, to the PJC definition of
next. Did we say in Rourke that was not error to submit producing cause defined that way?
I don't believe that's correct.
Rourke versus Garza?
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor. It found that there was evidence of producing cause in that case, and I don't think the jury charge was the issue in that case. But the fact is that nobody has a first clue what this means, efficient or exciting cause. I mean, we expect the jurors to find meaning in it, and it does not tell the jury what the two essential elements are or ask them if either of them has been proven.
But substantial factor will make it all clear.
No, substantial factor and but for. Compare it, for example, to the definition of proximate cause. The only difference legally between proximate cause and producing cause is foreseeability. If you put the definition from the PJC of producing cause next to the definition of proximate cause, it is impossible to figure that out. And yet, legally, that's the only difference. I see my time has expired, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please, the court, Mr. Taylor, present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the members of the court, Ford objected to the instruction on the basis that it didn't include the word manufacturing. One would think that if manufacturing's absence from that word and sentence was the problem, that Ford would tender a substantially and correctly worded instruction.
Of course, they don't have to.
Beg your pardon, Your Honor?
It's not their charge.
It's an...
Not their question, it's yours, and they don't have to.
We contend...
They can object, they don't have to take...
Well, we contend that what they're griping about is not the question, but rather the instruction. And under Rule 278, the instruction must be tendered in a substantially accurate form. That was the same matter that occurred in the Cooper case, although this court decided Cooper on other grounds.
There's nothing in the instruction that says defect happened during manufacturing, right?
Correct. The
defect could, I mean, could have been in the design, could have been any time before it left. I guess it could even be after it left.
No. The pattern jury charge, which Judge Flanagan adopted here, directs the jury's attention to the condition of the product when it left the possession of Ford. So there's no question whatsoever but that the jury was directed to consider whether there was some dangerous condition when it left the possession of Ford. Now, there are at least three reasons why this U-bolt assembly was defective. Number one, the legs of the U-bolt, if you think of a field goal on a football field, the legs of the U-bolt were not even, but were unequal in length. That's the first defect. And
does that relate to the depth of the sockets or not?
It doesn't. The depth of the sockets question was a good trial counsel trying to create a straw man and then knock it down for jury purposes. But they were,
if the torque on the nuts is the same, what difference does it make how long the bolt is?
What difference it makes is that whether it happened at the time or eventually prior to the accident, the unequal length in the U-bolt caused the assembly not to have the torquing and the power that it needed to hold it in place.
That's the part I know you say that, and it's several pages in the brief, but if the nut on each side is torqued down to whatever, 185 pounds or whatever it was, I forgot the number, but, then it doesn't make any difference whether the bolt's a foot long or an inch long.
It does make a difference because the uneven lengths is what caused the nuts eventually to loosen. We don't have to prove in a manufacturing defect case that the nuts were not at 185 foot-pounds at the time it left the assembly line. That gets into how or why it loosened. What we have to prove is that there's a defect in the manufacture of the product, and as I was saying, there are three. The first one is unequal legs. The second one is that, and let me back up and say how this U-bolt is constructed. The first thing you do with this piece of long metal is you have to make sure you've got the spiral rings around it so that you can put a nut on it. So that's the first thing that happens. Then it's red hot. And what they do is they clamp it in the middle, right down the center, so that there's a flattened portion. And then they lift it up like a football goal field. And so this part where my thumbs are is supposed to be flat and it's supposed to be centered. But in fact, the testimony is it was 3/4 of an inch off center. Also, because of the unequal lengths and the off center of the bottom, this clamping mechanism did not work as it was intended to be when it was manufactured. Now,
again, let me be sure I'm clear on this. The petitioner says that the problem with the off-center flat part on the U-part boat was that it would ride into the axle casing. And then if it did that, then it would obviously loosen, and then maybe the nuts would come off, so there you have it. But there was, the petitioner says there's no evidence that there was any indentation in the axle casing.
Thank you. The same issue as before, that's a straw man. They're trying to say that we have a burden to prove that there was an indentation and that caused the nuts to loosen. We don't have to prove that the nuts were loose at the time that it left. All we have to prove is that the product wasn't manufactured either as the specifications required or as planned output would expect. And to answer your question...
But you have to prove that that caused the thing to fall apart.
Absolutely. And we had evidence that prior to the first collision with the Pontiac Firebird, what happened, and let me explain on this U-bolt, once it's been assembled, it actually has nuts that come down on the four legs, and those nuts attach what's called a spring plate. That spring plate has a circle in the middle. So with my hand, if you show a circle in the spring plate, there's supposed to be a center pin that goes in the circle. It's designed such that you're not going to have any touching of the nut that holds the center pin to the circumference of the center plate. It's not supposed to touch at all. What we found when we examined this product at the time of the collision and thereafter is that there had been triangular marks throughout this circle of area, which was caused, according to the testimony, by that nut having a fatigue failure and moving around and rattling around and hitting that circumference. That circumference should not have any markings on it whatsoever if the product is working the way it's supposed to be manufactured. And so the three things we know that are wrong here is the unequal lengths, the fact that you don't have the center of the flatness correctly in the middle, it's 3/4 of an inch off, and thirdly, what I haven't mentioned yet, is that when the nuts on the assembly line go down, there was a differential of more than 5 millimeters between one nut, which was at, I believe, 13 millimeters, and the other nut, which was at 10.5 millimeters. Now, I want to make my point and bring it back to bridge to why there wasn't a correct tender of this submission by Ford. The specifications for this assembly are in the record. It's Defendant's Exhibit 16. The only specification that we know of in this document is that the legs of the football field goal, of this U-bolt, the legs are supposed to be 228 millimeters plus or minus 2. So it can be a low of 226 or a high of 230. There's nothing in the written specification about when the nuts are applied, if they're supposed to be even or not. There's nothing in the specification about the location of the flatness of the bottom of the U-bolt. There's nothing in the specification about how much differential is allowed if the U-bolt legs are different. And so those three things are what we call planned output. There is a difference between specifications and planned output. Let me give an example. We know when you buy food at a Wendy's, for example, there's supposed to be certain ingredients in that cheeseburger. We can look at the specifications to know exactly what the ingredients are. However, if you have one of these widely reported horror cases where something foreign is in that hamburger, like a finger or a mouse tail, you don't have to prove the specifications to know that the planned output for that cheeseburger, according to all the sibling cheeseburgers out there, as the case law suggests, isn't what it was supposed to be. And so we know that there is an intellectual difference between failure to conform to planned output and failure to conform to specifications, which is here. In Defendant's Exhibit 16, we only have a specification of one side of the leg, not a specification for the rest. And so we know that planned output is part of this case. Now back to my point about why the instruction is not correctly worded.
Before you get there, I'm still not entirely clear on your answer to Justice Heck's question about the nuts. Put a U-bolt on a pipe or something, tighten it down. You want the two legs to be equal because it looks symmetrical and you think it's better. And we've probably both put on dozens or hundreds over the years. Kids' products or putting up a basketball goal for the kids or whatever. But if they're tightened down so that the torque is equal, what does it matter if one leg is a little longer than the other? I know you said it doesn't. I don't know if I heard your explanation, at least not a convincing one to me yet, about why it doesn't matter.
It matters.
As long as they're both tightened down equally.
It matters a lot. And here's why. We're not saying, in order to be successful in this case, that the torquing at the time of manufacture was wrong. It may very well be that 185 foot-pounds occurred on all four nuts. That is not essential to our case because that gets into the how or the why it became loose. What does matter is this. Let's assume that it was torqued exactly correctly. Had it been torqued correctly, one would not reasonably expect that it would come apart in the absence of some force causing it to break away. So the fact that it came apart raises the question of, well, what is it about the U-bolt assembly that caused it to come apart? It's not because they didn't torque it correctly at the beginning. It's because the legs are uneven. It's because the bottom portion of the U-bolt is not flat and it's off center.
Well, that reasoning is from the conclusion back to my question, because Ford's going to tell you the reason is your client ran into a car, and that's what caused it to come apart. Not that it was the legs were uneven caused it to come apart. So there are other potential reasons. I need to come you to come from the other direction, not conclusion to my question, but reason to my question. Why does it matter about the length of the legs? I still don't understand that.
Okay. With the last part of your question, I would say that whether the collision caused the train to come out is purely a jury question. There was evidence that the jury could reasonably find that, you know what, this drivetrain disengaged prior to the collision, not as a result of the collision, and we were able to persuade the jury on that question. But getting to your the meat of what you're asking me, we only need to demonstrate that the defective condition, which I've given you three of them, was the producing cause of why that rear bolt assembly came apart. What we know is that as far as the legs are concerned, it didn't conform to specifications. And what we know is that because of the distance of the nut going down on the four legs and the failure to be in the middle on the flattening at the bottom, is that planned output was not complied with. So we know that there was a defect. Now, when you get to the testimony, Mr. Ledesma said, I heard something pop, and my car jumped up and down prior to hitting the Pontiac. So we know that some event occurred before collision. What we also know from Gert Ertz, let me mention for a moment about him. He's a metallurgist. He's a mechanical engineer. He has looked at over 150 leaf wheel assemblies over the 5 to 6 year period prior to the trial. He did work for Rossini International, which is a company south of the United States that makes 40% to 50% of all leaf wheel assemblies in the United States. He has examined these and done a failure analysis for 5 different car manufacturers, including Ford. And based on his experience and training, he said there would not be these triangular markings on the perimeter of the circle on the tie plate but for the fact that it was loose and it was vibrating. So, Justice Wainwright, we don't need to prove that the looseness and vibration was at the time of manufacturer. We simply need to prove that the defective manufacturing of this U-bolt caused the loosening and eventual failure.
Let me ask you about the charge real quick. Would you agree that the question that Ford tendered, or the instruction that Ford tendered, if it had said a manufacturing defect is a physical departure from the product's planned output that renders it unreasonably dangerous, that would have been a better instruction?
Still incorrect. Let me tell you what I think would have been the legally correct instruction. We should have followed what this court said in Cooper, what this court said in Ridgeway, what this court said in Torrington and American Tobacco. Four things. A manufacturing defect arises when the product deviates in terms of its construction, its quality, from specifications, and planned output. Those are the four magic words that this court has told us repeatedly, even as recently as in Cooper.
So you would agree then that there's a problem in the jury charge?
No.
Yeah, let's talk about the charge that's been submitted. And the jury found zero negligence on the decimal, correct?
Correct.
So isn't it reasonable to conclude that, for me it's reasonable to conclude that they didn't buy whatever argument Ford was putting forth in a jury, to the jury. So why is it harmless error, as this court has decided most recently in Bed Bath & Beyond and other cases, why isn't it harmless error to submit this instruction, which, as I understand, is given to the trial court as guidance for these type of cases?
It absolutely would be harmless error, and let me try to answer the two questions simultaneously. We're saying that the pattern jury charge got the job done. It is correct, not because it's just the pattern jury charge, but because it defines defect. My able opponent told you a few minutes ago that there's no case in Texas that talks about the way the pattern jury charge says it. That's not true. Just look at the Cooper case. Justice Willett, writing for the majority, after he cites what I just talked about, construction quality, planned output specs, the very next sentence says what the pattern jury charge says. And that's what this court keeps doing. It talks about what it is, and then it says right afterwards what the pattern jury charge includes. The thing about the defect question, it's true that it doesn't define the word manufacturing. That's true. But when you look at it side by side, since you know defect means a condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous, then you just know that it means a manufacturing condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous. So we think the pattern jury charge gets it done. The charge tells the jury, hey, when you don't define a term, give it its common and ordinary meaning.
But why wouldn't the jury be a reasonable person on the jury just as inclined to think that a manufacturing defect was making something after being designed?
Well, we disagree that this case was submitted on two different theories. There was a design defect theory that was pled and abandoned before this trial ever began. The only evidence and the only question in this case was manufacturing defect.
Of course, in most cases, or many cases at least two defects are obvious: design and manufacturing, often marketing, breach of compliance warning, just in the abstract. Do you think it would be better to distinguish between the manufacturing defect, given the four words that you've used or whatever the case law supports, and the design defect or not?
You have that choice. This court could so say. But think about the Turner decision in 1979. If you're going to do that, then you should apply it prospectively. Shouldn't apply to this case. If you're going to apply it retroactively, it's harmless error because there's not a concern about the jury getting confused about design here. This was only manufacturing, so it should be harmless error. But in the abstract, you could do that if you want to. Remember what they submitted. It was Section 2A of the Restatement Third. They didn't use the Cooper standard. They used a standard that's never been adopted by anybody, and that's not correct. They inject the word design. They're actually doing the very thing they're trying to stay away from. We don't want the jury, they claim, to get confused between manufacturing and design, and yet they use the word design in the very question they tender.
Taylor, we haven't talked at all today about expert reliability. So you mentioned the Cooper case. Cooper, the plaintiff in that case lost because, not because of anything involving the charge, but because we deemed his expert unreliable. And we haven't spoken about that today, but let me ask you a question in the final minute we have. If the court were to deem one of the experts below reliable, the metallurgist or the reconstructionist, and the other one unreliable, does the verdict stand? Does
yes.
It send it back?
Still would affirm because of Ledesma's testimony and the fact that there's no issue about the U-bolt being out of sync with the specifications. Even if you threw everything else out, we still win. The other thing I want to quickly say to Justice Brister's earlier question about whether there was waiver on Dan May. If you read that record, it's clear as a bell that the judge backed off his original decision. He first said, you're not going to be allowed to go into causation. Then he backed off and he said, no, I'll let you talk about causation, sir, but I'm going to allow cross-examination on the Stern report. Well, the Stern report kills them. They had an expert go out after Ledesma reported the incident. I'm out of time. May I finish answering your question? Thank you. Ledesma reported the accident. They sent out an expert, and he said in writing, there's a defect here that caused the accident. They couldn't live with that, so they had to get their company man, Mr. May, to testify. The judge said, if you're going to testify on causation, I'm going to let them bring in the Stern report. The lawyer asked for a two-minute break. They came back, and they abandoned any attempt whatsoever to preserve error because they made a strategic choice not to go there, and that's not an error that should undo this judgment. So in summation, we would ask to affirm because the PJC is correct, and if you think it's not correct, it's still harmless error and should not apply to undo the result here. Thank you.
Further questions?
One other question, Chief. Just a factual clarification. Now, when the axle detached in the back, that caused the drive shaft to uncouple in the front, correct? Because that's the only way driving forward, the axle drive shaft digging to the pavement could cause the rear of the vehicle to rise. Is that right? Or
well,
did the drive shaft detach in the back?
You're testing my knowledge. I didn't try this case, and I'm going based on what the record reflects. My belief is that the drive shaft unattached in the back, not the front. But I don't know a lot about
cars. How would that cause a vehicle going forward to rise in the back?
Right. I understand that. The best I can answer from the record is that we've got five leaves in that assembly. The first leaf up here became unattached because that spring plate and the center pin broke. That disattachment allowed the wheel assembly, or the drive shaft rather, to come apart. It's surprising how short it is. It doesn't take much for it to drive apart. And what's happening is when you're going down Justin Lane and you're turning, there's all that pressure on the right dual wheel. And so that centrifugal force, coupled with what had happened in the loosening, caused it to pop and then eventually to shear. And once that happened, the drivetrain fell and pronged into the pavement, causing it to go up. So I believe the answer to your question is it's in the back, not the front. But I may be corrected. I'm not an engineer. Thank you.
Mr. Morgan, do you know the answer to that question?
The plaintiff's theory was that the plaintiff's theory was that your question was where
the drive shaft, did it come apart in the front?
It was
digging to the pavement, no. Caused the rear of the vehicle
exactly
to come forward.
Their theory was that it remained attached to the rear axle, which and the rear axle moved to the rear on the right hand side, pulling the drive shaft out of the transmission in the front.
That seems to be the only way that moving forward, that drive shaft would cause the rear of the vehicle to
crash. Right, that's right. And their theory is that occurred before the collision and caused it. Go through a few points very quickly. In response to Judge Brister's earlier question, the preservation of error and Dan May's testimony is addressed in our reply brief, pages 23 and 24. The handout that we presented did correctly submit the definition of a manufacturing defect when substantially correct form. The suggestion that there is some commonly held meaning of manufacturing defect is belied by the testimony of the plaintiff's own expert, who steadfastly insisted that it could mean that the product didn't function as intended. He had no clue what the law thinks a manufacturing defect is, what the law says a manufacturing defect is, and this is an engineer, a professional testifying expert in product liability cases, and he insisted that that's not what it is, and that's just wrong. The reference to Arch's reliance on the scratches on the tie plate in the following places in the record, he concedes that those could have also been caused by the accident itself, but he just didn't. If the center bolt and nut had still been there, which he contends they were not at the time of the accident, as at 5RR23-30 and 67-69. The reference to the bargain that we were offered to get in the testimony of our expert if we agreed to the admission of a hearsay report from this guy named Stern, that's not the correct way to submit an expert's testimony. The judge said, well, I will let your expert testify on causation, but in exchange for that, I'm going to allow in this Stern report, which contains hearsay, because it reports what a mechanic supposedly told Stern was the cause of the accident. And we objected on that, and that's not the kind of bargain you have to reach in order to get admissible testimony into the record.
Sounds correct, but just as Willette asked a question about the Cooper case, the response was, if this court throws out plaintiff's expert's reports, testimony, that the plaintiff still wins here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That the plaintiff still wins if those reports plaintiff's expert's reports are disregarded. What's your response to that?
I don't see how that's possible, Your Honor. The only testimony about the cause of this accident, what caused it, that would link it to anything wrong with the vehicle, comes from the plaintiff's expert. The only other testimony they presented was from Ledesma himself, who simply described how the accident happened. And unless this court is prepared to say that was a res ipsa loquitur, then they've got no evidence that this accident was
caused. So what if the court deemed one of the experts reliable and one unreliable? Is the court's, and should we simply, does the verdict stand? Do we send it back? Do we render? If we say the metallurgist is okay, but not the reconstructionist, or vice versa, what impact does that have?
Well, the key to the plaintiff's case is Gert Arch, who is their engineer. He's the only one who testified, who presented any evidence that would link the accident to this purported defect in the U-bolts. Their accident reconstructionist is the one who said, well, it was caused, by looking at these grainy photographs, what happened was that the drive shaft fell. There's no dispute the drive shaft did come out. The question is when. And he's the only one who provides any evidence that it came out before the accident and caused it. So the exclusion of either one of them means that there is no evidence to connect the accident itself.
What about the plaintiff's testimony that happened? That's what he experienced.
Well, the only thing the plaintiff said was that he experienced the vehicle lurching, the rear of the vehicle lurching to the right as if someone had run into it. And then he lost control. I mean, he did not say that the drive shaft fell. And he got out later, once the accident sequence was completed, he saw the drive shaft had fallen, but there's no dispute about that. Another question is running out of my time.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted in the court. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.
Thank you.